It's time now for Radio Theater, and we're joined this morning by Tom Isbell, professor of theater at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing?
Just fine. So I want to talk with you this morning about collaboration, and this is something that I've seen that I didn't realize was as common as I thought it was. I think I grew up thinking that conductors of orchestras or bands, that directors, choreographers, the way it worked was they came in with their vision, and that was the plan. They'd teach it to the performers. The performers would do what they wanted. They realized the director's vision, and that was that. That was the way it was supposed to be. And then suddenly this art of collaboration, and I realize in jazz there's improvisation, in theater there's improvisation, but collaboration is not really improvisation. It really is a focused design, but it's an ensemble process.
Yeah, very much so. Well, it's interesting because I think it's the blessing and the curse, more often the blessing of theater, is that you have all these people working together. And on a good day, you say, oh my goodness, thank goodness there are all these people with these ideas making this show better. Mm-hmm. And then there are the bad days. You go, why can't I do this by myself? Why are all these other people around here?
but ensemble productions are by design unavoidably collaborative.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start with a production process. I mean, we started in March for the show that's opening in 2 weeks. And so, we met all spring. We met infrequently over the email over the summer. And then, of course, very seriously this fall. And it's all about bringing forth ideas, sorting, making sure we're all on the same page. It's very, very collaborative.
And is it really fair to think of it as sort of a linear continuum of how much you allow the performer to contribute their ideas? I mean, you hear about movies these days, they always show the outtakes where actors are trying different lines out to see if that one plays better or not. And so what degree do you let out the leash, so to speak?
I think it's a case-by-case basis, depending on the production, depending on the actor, depending on the circumstances. Films are different because once the screenplay has been sold and it's in the hands of the director and the actors, they can change any word they want. The screenwriter gives them that right.
Really?
That's right. And they're getting a fair amount of money for that. So everyone rewrites. The playwright, by contrast, their work is copyrighted. So they say, well, you can do this play to a production company, but you can't change a word without my permission. And if a work is published, same thing. So it's not a matter of letting the actors improvise words, but I do like to give actors a long leash in terms of coming up with ideas, because goodness knows they're going to come up with better ideas than anything I come up with. So I can kind of come up with mileposts or general ideas and then kind of shape what their impulses are. And hopefully I've cast based on those types.
Well, it's gracious of you to say that the performers will come up with better ideas than you. That's true. Well, yeah. I don't know. But I mean, as far as letting out that leash, I mean, you've got your vision, whether it's fully formed or not, when you start the process as a director, for example.
Right.
But the threat is that either that vision of yours will be enhanced or it'll be diluted. So how do you bring them back to the center? I mean, can the director say, okay, now I need to call the shots here and say, this is what we're going to do?
Yeah, and again, I think some directors, we've all worked with very different directors, and they have different processes in making that happen. I think we're blessed here with having terrific, terrific students. Our students do an awful lot of the design work, and of course the students do the acting. So, I think that's the director's primary responsibility, creating this world and making sure we all stay within this world. Mm. And every so often an actor or a designer will stray, and so you just kind of bring them back. And every so often I as the director will stray, and they need to bring me back. And, right now working on Spoon River with Andy Kust, who's the musical director, it's a fantastic collaboration because it's truly one of those experiences where he makes me better. His questions, which are completely non-threatening, but they're wonderfully smart, he'll say, why is this song here? Why are we doing this here? And my answer is, oh, right, good question. Well, let's answer that. And mm-hmm. then we'll come up with something. And, of course, he's so talented and smart and wonderful that then the script improves and the production improves because of what he brings to it. So that, there's an example of a collaboration that I absolutely adore and love.
It's Lennon and McCartney right there.
Well, we don't like to brag.
Well, but yeah. It's a yin and yang thing. But I imagine that the more people you bring into the process, too many cooks, as they say, you could tend to kind of lose something unique I think about pop songs and country songs these days. You look at the person who wrote the song. It's not a person. It's 6, 7, 8 people who get their name attached. And that's why country songs start to all sound the same.
I know. Well, it's the same with screenplays, too, because so often, and you can tell by the credits because of the way the union is, if there's an ampersand between the writers' names, that means they're writing partners. And that's okay. But if there's the word and, that implies those two probably never met. You know, they sold it to the studio. The studio said, yeah, this is good, but it needs a rewrite. We'll give it to this person. They did a rewrite. They said, yeah, this is okay. We need another rewrite. So it goes through 6, 7, 8 hands, and then it's lost its complete, you know, original focus.
Wow.
Yeah, that happens all the time with film. So theater is very different. I think, you know, I think theater is blessed in the way it's structured in general like that.
So Spoon River, it's a 100-year-old collection. Edgar Lee Masters put these together a century ago.
Right.
And it's something that you're taking on. It's opening, in, as you say, 2 weeks from now, October 1st.
October 1st.
The process of this play. Now, it's not like it's a new play that's still in development, still kind of trying to find its way. This is a story that's been around for a long time. So collaboration in this sense, is it changed because of the age of the work?
It's changed because of the age of the work. It's changed because of this particular team. I would imagine if we had a different team of artists working on it, it would be different still. You know, so the Book of Poems, it's 244 epitaphs, came out 100 years ago, created quite a sensation because there was nothing like it. You know, one magazine said it was the greatest book of the 20th century. And it went through a lot of adaptation. There was a radio show adaptation in the 50s. In 1963, there was a Broadway musical.
Mm-hmm.
And when you did this play, that was the version you had to do because the Masters estate sold that to that team. Charles Aidman, I think, did that. Well, now the Book of Poems is back in the public domain, and so anyone can do an adaptation. So this is an original adaptation. So Andy and I took these poems, these epitaphs, chose the ones we wanted to work with, inserted folk songs and hymns that are in the public domain. So this is a brand new production.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I see people will recognize many of the pieces because some of them are kind of in our vocabulary, especially for older people who've grown up with the book at all.
Yeah.
And some will be brand new, and some songs are going to be completely surprising. But I think most of the songs, if not all of the songs, are somewhere in our DNA, like The Water is Wide, for example, or these Civil War songs, or some of the hymns like Blessed Assurance. Somewhere we've heard them. You know, if we didn't grow up with them, we've heard them. And so I think there's a familiarity to that.
So this is news to me. I thought you were working from an existing script.
I think a lot of people think that because there was an existing script.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when things pass into the public domain, there's not a big announcement about it. So I think I'd been waiting for this. It's only happened in the last 10 or so years.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that, oh, okay, well, we can do our own adaptation. And then Andy was hired and, you know, we had, there's a square dance in there, of course. And who's choreographing that square dance? Oh, it's Rebecca Katz-Harwood who is doing that.
I know.
flashback. I mean, and I think there's one of the things that we're enjoying about this is I think we're going to surprise some people, not just that it's a new adaptation, but you hear 244 epitaphs, you think, okay, graveyard down play, but it's really about life. I mean, one critic said, it's amazing that people speaking from the dead can create such a play about life and say so much about life.
Well, but an epitaph doesn't talk about death, it talks about what their life was.
Exactly, so, yeah. Exactly. And I think the play is very raucous and funny and fun and upbeat and sad and tragic and mm-hmm. angry and just kind of everything.
Vaguely echoes to me Our Town in a way.
Sort yes.
of a look back at what was.
Absolutely. In fact, we talked about that from day one. It's, in a sense, it's a continuation of Our Town, even though Our Town was written 10 years or so after this play, after the book came out. It seems like this play starts, you know, Act 3 of Our Town is there in the cemetery. This is like Act 4.
Mm.
And then it kind of goes back also and travels back and forth in time.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the fact that you guys were in the creative process really speaks to collaboration even more than I had thought when we started this interview. So.
Well, yeah. And, that, you know, and it's changed last night. Just last night, we changed. I mean, we opened in 2 weeks. Last night, we changed the order of one of the first monologues with another one. And it made such a difference. It's just a little thing. And we were continuing to kind of change and rework, et cetera.
I'm fairly certain you're not doing all of the epitaphs in this story.
It's no.
Far too many.
That's
so
far too many.
Did you decide on which of the ones you're going to include before rehearsals began, or did the students get to pick and choose some as well?
I decided, so we did need a script going into the process. So I chose, and then we started rehearsing, and then I saw which ones didn't speak to us as much. So I cut about a 10 or so, I would say, based on that. I don't think we've added any new ones that weren't originally in there. What we did do, though, is I cast an ensemble. I didn't assign roles at first. And so the first week of rehearsal was this cast of student artists, student actors working together, collaborating. And then they kind of found favorites that they were drawn to. And I tried to honor that then when I did cast the roles. So they're each playing about 6 or 7 roles. Mm-hmm. I think we've got about 60 or so characters in the piece.
Does it play more like a series of vignettes, or does it weave a longer narrative through all of them?
There is a thread of, there's one poem Jonathan Houghton, who Masters himself said was very autobiographical. It's basically him, and so that thread goes through. But within that, of course, it is a series of vignettes, series of monologues. But as much as possible, we created scenes, we created events. I mean, there's a number of pieces he wrote about the Civil War, so there's a whole Civil War section that's very physical. So I think it's more than just, you know, people standing up and talking. It's far more physicalized than that.
Well, and that the students came in not knowing necessarily which of the monologues they were going to do.
Right.
Probably the collaborative process really has to come into play then, because they're sort of making it up as they go. You're not casting a person to a certain epitaph with in mind how that person's going to play it, because you don't even know who's going to play it.
That's right. And our intention there was to say, okay, let's own this world. I mean, you know, as actors, we get in the habit of saying, okay, blah, 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 my line, blah, 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 my line. And I wanted to get the sense that, you know, all these characters are ours. Mm-hmm. We are this community. And then we can figure out later on who's going to play exactly whom. And that's been decided now. But at first, and so there's the tremendous ownership of this this play, this event, this town, this fictional town of Spoon River.
Mm. Well, I think that's kind of a way to look at it. What I was saying earlier about whether collaboration can enhance or dilute the process, the fact that this is about a town, and you think about all the cliches, but it takes a village. It really does in this sense. So
it's true, And this was the perfect example for me of a collaboration where it works. I've just been thrilled with it. Yeah,
great. Tom, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Chris.
Tom Isbell is a professor of theater here at UMD. Joined us to talk about theater this morning, the art of collaboration. Spoon River opens in 2 weeks here at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Funding provided for radio theater by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.